Курс рубля может безнаказанно становиться объектом финансовых
спекуляций. Послание Владимира Путина разочаровало рынок.
Рубль уже третий день подряд обновляет исторический минимум.
Страна валюта поставила новый исторический рекорд.
На фоне снижения мировых цен на нефть.
За баррель сегодня дают... Минфин опасается, что цена нефти может упасть значительно ниже.
Ситуация достаточно сложная на рынке нефти. Все ожидали, что...
В 2015 году может опуститься до 80 долларов. В бюджет этого года...
He accused the West of trying to destroy and dismember Russia. He trumpeted the annexation of Crimea, which he called hallowed ground for Russians. And he said speculators were behind the dramatic decline in the ruble's value. Speculators he pledged to punish. With the ruble and oil prices falling and the Russian economy reeling, Vladimir Putin offered no apologies, no retreat, and no plan in his annual State of the Nation speech. But despite the bluster and denial, Putin's luck may be running out, as the economic costs of his Ukraine adventure begin to hit home. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from London, back by popular demand after a long absence, is Kirill Kobanin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. Welcome back, Kirill.
Hello.
And also joining us via Skype from New York City is Nina Khrushcheva, a professor at the New School and author of the recently published book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. Welcome back, Nina. Well, according to the political analyst Leonid Bershitsky, writing in Bloomberg yesterday, Putin gave, quote, the most pitiful State of the Nation speech of his extraordinary lucky career and is, quote, falling off the wire. I want to throw this question to both of you. Given everything that's gone down this week, I mean, the ruble fell below $50, to the dollar for the first time. Oil still below 70 a barrel. It's going to probably continue to fall. The scrapping of the South Stream pipeline project, which was a major diplomatic defeat for Putin. What did you see as the main takeaway of Putin's speech? Because I tend to agree with Bershitsky. I saw three D's: defiance, denial, and delusion. What are your thoughts, Kirill? Why don't you jump in first? It's been a while since we've heard your voice. Our listeners are dying to hear it.
I'll add another one D to your list of D's: disappointment. Mm-hmm. Not just a disappointment of those who are listening to this or waiting for this speech and so on, because, you know, there were a lot of rumors about what Putin would having to tell, or to start new liberalization, or to start new Cold War, or to declare himself a new emperor, whatever. Whatever, absolutely. So I read a lot of mm-hmm. rumors about what's going on, and even, you know, serious people like, you know, economic experts, or some people from high echelon of Kremlin, and so on, all of them, they're speaking that something will happen. Nothing mm-hmm. happened. But it's very important that disappointment, it's not just from the part of those who were waiting for the speech. Disappointment, I can read disappointment in the very speech itself.
Mm-hmm. Delivery was awful. I mean, this was not he's been off his game for a while. We've talked about this in the podcast occasionally, but I mean, he just looked awful and his delivery was awkward.
I think that Putin is very disappointed with the world.
I'm
absolutely sure that he had some, you know, hopes that you know, something will happen, you know, something, you know, the things will turn to good in the spring or summer or something like this, or that West will agree with the occupation.
We'll all bow down to Prince Vladimir.
Yes. I mean, whatever, but nothing of this kind happened, actually. Secondly, he is disappointed in his own politics. Of course, everyone can say, following Angela Merkel's infamous phrase, that he is living in a different reality or other reality and so on. But he knows about, you know, the exchange rate, the situation in the financial sector and so on. But he understands at the same time that he can do anything about this. With this, and that
well,
is
he could. He could pull out of Ukraine. He could give Crimea back, and he could liberalize the economy. He can do all
those
things.
You know, everyone understands, and himself, he himself understands that he cannot. Putin cannot do all this thing. So he is.
You mean he's psychologically incapable of admitting defeat?
Psychologically, politically, pragmatically, whatever, ideologically, whatever. He invented his own ideology. He believed in this, and now he tried to depend on this, but he failed.
Mm-hmm.
And the ideology failed itself. I'd like to focus our attention on a very, really, it's a very funny phrase about that Crimea and Kherson, of course.
Yeah, no, that's
it's a new sanctuary.
The new Jerusalem.
Yes, Jerusalem and so on. But that is the a serious, not political, just political mistake, and it's very offensive and insulting for, you know, Israel and Arabs and Muslims and so on.
Not to mention Tatars.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's very stupid. It's just stupid. And ideology cannot be stupid. Ideology must be, you know...
I don't know, the Soviet Union got by 70 years with a pretty stupid ideology.
No, it was based on the quite interesting, entertaining at the same time, and serious works by Karl Marx, Engels, and even Lenin. So it's different. So when you're starting to tell, you know, fairy tales about, you know, old princes who had been baptized somewhere in Crimea and so on for modern population, it's just stupid. And
he was talking about Prince Vladimir of Kyiv, by the way. So the Ukrainians could just as easily use his argument.
And moreover, he was Scandinavian, by the way. So I think Crimea from this point must be, you know, a sort of Swedish or Norwegian sanctuary, maybe. I'm not going to analyze everything, stupid things which he was talking about.
No, we'd need five podcasts to
do that. Yes, yes. But the very intonation, the very context of the speech was not just denial or delusion and so on. It's disappointment. It's just disappointment. And that is the most important word to describe the recent situation with Putin's regime. It's a huge, deep disappointment in everything. And absolutely no idea how to improve the situation, what to do next, and so on. It's just emptiness. So the speech was about emptiness.
The speech was about nothing. And the optics were awful. The optics were awful. I mean, I was live blogging it. And, I mean, the applause was tepid. Medvedev fell asleep again.
As usual.
But the applause was tepid. People were just going through the motions. But in Putin himself... just was amazing. His delivery, I've never seen his delivery so bad in one of these set pieces. Nina, what was your takeaway?
Well, I actually agree with some of what you guys said and disagree with others. I do agree that Putin himself somehow lacked conviction in delivering the speech. He believes in what he says, I'm sure, but he's not sure that that kind of grandiose delusion that he was putting forward is shared by everybody. And that's, I think that's what we sensed and felt. It was a very Soviet speech. For the first time, it was not a Putin speech. It was a Soviet speech. He was very much Stalin-esque in that delivery. He was talking about the speculators. He was talking about, exactly, he was talking about the government controlling of food. He was talking about the diversification. And, you know, we need to punish those who don't allow businesses to develop, which, of course, a very Stalin-esque formulas, as we know, to kind of create a problem and then blame the rest for that problem. And that, I think, maybe in this sense, you're right, it is the beginning of his end, because he lost his Putinism. He really was moving into something that is very tired for all Russians, whether they're young or not young, because genetically we know how that Soviet ideology worked by the end. I agree with Kirill, Soviet ideology was not stupid, because the idea was saving humanity, and it worked for a while.
The Soviet application of it, I guess, is what I would...
Soviet application to it was Russian, which is basically imperial, and that in this sense, it was stupid. But by the end, of course, it worn out. And I think the problem for Putin, he started his speech yesterday is where the Soviet Union left off. There was very little conviction. We are almost in the old Brezhnev era. I also disagree about something that Kirill said, that Khersonis is a stupid formula. I actually think it's not. I think that that's the only way he can make this ideological unity for the Russians, is that say this is the cradle of our civilization. And I think, Brian, we talked about it. Remember when he was meeting with young historians?
Yeah.
We mentioned that it was very important to say, Russians, you came out of there. And, of course, the Kievan princes, they came from Novgorod, so they were Russian Kievan princes, and there's a lot of, you can have a lot of debate about that. So he was trying to anchor the civilization, but I think he also was saying something more. He was saying that, don't think that I'm going to get out. In fact,
that's what he was doing there, yeah.
That's what he was doing. He was actually saying that these areas are sacred for the Russians, the Sevastopol, the Korsun, the Khersonis. These are the very important ones, so don't expect me to get out. But I felt, remember Stalin's speech of 1946, we are going to, you know, tighten the belts and a few more petiletki, a few more five-year plans, and we'll catch it. So that feels, that I felt Putin of Stalin of 1946. But Stalin of 1946, it's the beginning of the end.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think it's interesting? I mean, because I agree with you about the way he framed Crimea was basically saying no compromise on this. But the fact that he left out Donbass, he didn't say, I don't think he said anything about Donbass.
He didn't.
Does that mean that's negotiable?
Well, I think, I mean, way I read it is that Donbass already voted. I mean, Donbass is de facto Russian. And he doesn't really need to deal with it. What he was talking about is that there are other areas that are more important to us. He was talking about Odessa. He mentioned Odessa again, yeah, which I think we should watch out for. But what you are completely correct about is that he didn't offer any solutions. I think he really is, he lost his grounding. He lost his Putinism. And he's reaching back into the arsenal of Soviet leaders, but really, I don't think really, bodes well for his own future, because the reason he was so successful is he had a very modern twist on whatever the Soviets did, and that twist seemed to be waning away.
Yeah. The contrast is so sharp between this speech and the Crimean annexation speech back in March. And again, I come coming back to the audience reaction, because the audience reaction is relevant. This is the elite that he's speaking to in the room. He's speaking to the nation and the world writ large, but that's the elite sitting there in the room. And they just looked, going through the motions is the best way I could describe it. Kirill, you noted some of the expectations that were out there before the speech. How would you read this? I mean, the way they reacted, can we read into anything about that? Is the elite getting tired of this man, maybe, or some of the elite?
Well, I'm not sure that the whole elite was there in this.
The upper echelons of the political elite were there. Both houses, of parliament.
Yes, formally.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah, Timchenko wasn't there.
Right, okay. Yes, and so on. But say, I'm not joking, because I can't name or describe Russian MPs like real elite, political elite in this country, and so on. They're just servants. So several days ago, there were an interview with several MPs from Duma who were speaking just directly about their role and what they are doing there in Duma and so on, that they are trying to cover some real things, not to do something real. All these, stupid laws and legislations and so on. Oh, we are just, trying to attract our electorate and so on. But actually, we are trying to cover up something real and interesting, which is going on, which is not such, sexy in some sense. Yes, and so on. So it's not real political elite, first of all. Secondly, and of course, as a servant, they must
But react. Remember, it wasn't just the both houses of parliament that were there. The government was there. I don't think it's fair to say this wasn't a good chunk of the elite. That's the entire church elite was there. He was speaking to the at least the formal rulers of Russia. Nina, you wanted to jump in here.
No, I just wanted to sort of follow up on what Kirill was saying, is that this is that was a bad reaction, and brings me back to my point that he really starts with the time when the Soviet Union was, or say first Stalinism and then Brezhnevism, were no longer as popular as they used to, because all these various, they say, zhidkie applaudissementy, this very kind of random applause, that's really a bad sign. And so I think next time the speech that he delivers would be with the script where you need to applause. And that is really bad sign for him. It does seem that because he was so unconvinced and he was so Soviet in his delivery, all his entourage, I mean, the elites, whether the important elites or non-important elites, they were not taking it because there was no more Putin in that argument. And that Soviet argument they heard before, that's not the argument that they want. They want great Russia of Russia. They don't want great Russia of this dying Soviet formulas.
Kirill, you indicated you wanted to jump in there.
Yeah, it's quite funny that we are returning to the Soviet times of Kremlinology, discussing the order, how the members of Politburo were staying on the mausoleum during, November the 7th and so on, the parade, or trying to discuss or to make some interpretation of the, Brezhnev speech on 25th Congress of CPSU and so on. So it's in some sense, formally. So I insist, formally, we are returning to the, to the 1979, 1980.
In terms of form, yeah. In terms of form.
Formally,
yeah.
But really, actually, of course, the reality is on the one hand is simpler, and on the other hand is more sophisticated. Simpler because. So I can't agree totally with Leonid Bershinsky. Of course, he hasn't lost his, luck in some sense. 100%.
I wrote that this week, actually.
Yes,
and we're going to get to that.
But he lost his stuff. I'd like to follow the Nina's idea about Putinism. He lost his Putinism as a sort of intermediate political, collection of political and economic ideas, which is, half Soviet, half, neoliberal, and so on. So he just lost the very idea what to do with this country and with this society and so on. Because in the previous years, Putinism was a quite smart collection and balance between, Soviet or, pseudo-Soviet rhetoric and neoliberal measures and so on. And now it's all over.
Right. I want to throw a cautionary word in here, though, because I have written off Putin many times. We have all written off Putin many times. And every time he's come roaring back. Kirill, when we started this podcast exactly 3 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, we were writing off Putin when the protest movement first gathered steam. When the Navalny phenomenon came up, I was writing off Putin. I wrote a lengthy blog post, why the Kremlin is losing and why Navalny is winning. We keep getting burned here. Are we going to get burned again? I mean, is it premature to say he's losing his stuff, I guess? Nina, go ahead.
I agree with you. I don't think we should write him off. I think we were talking about, this is something to remember, we're talking about that particular speech.
Yeah. And what it signifies. And what it signifies.
Kirill and I believe that he lost his Putinism. It doesn't mean that he doesn't regain it, 2 weeks from now.
Right.
These things can happen, because I think what he lost it with is sort of the oil prices has gone down, and he kind of lost the Putin, because the essence of Putinism was the use of the oil prices for all sorts of political moves, and that's what he lost. I don't know if you guys heard that funny. I mean, I thought it was an anecdote. Maybe I read it in you. I heard it in Moscow too. Is that what would be what next year Vladimir Putin and oil prices have in common?
Right.
In 63. So in some sense there is that loss of Putinism. But you're right. We shouldn't be burying him because he's a judo master, and didn't he just get yet another belt or another something, another badge. He may find, I mean, because he goes tactically with all the developments that happen in the world, in the country, and he finds those openings and then he uses to his advantage. So we don't know what those things may be.
I mean, we got to be careful about two things. One of them is looking at Putin like he's omnipotent, because there's a tendency for that narrative to get out there, and it's been out there.
Or stupid, by the way.
No, he's definitely not stupid. But then there's the tendency to keep periodically writing him off with every crisis. And we're trying to steer. And this is, I guess, what I'd like to talk about. I put a blog up this week saying, you know, Putin's luck has run out. I wrote it in equivocal. I wrote it so I didn't qualify it for a reason to get clicks. It did work because the blog did okay. But this is the question we have to ask, because if you look back at this week, starting on Monday, and I said December 1st might be remembered as the day the tide turned, because what happened on December 1st? Well, the ruble went below 50, oil went below 70, and South Stream was scrapped. Those are three, and the next day, December 2nd, the Russian government admitted what we all know was obvious, the economy's headed to recession next year. And was later chastised for doing that, by the way, according to a report in I believe it was Kommersant. But the taking these things together, I mean, these are the fundamentals of the Russian economy: a stable ruble, high energy prices, and the ability to use those high energy prices to exert political dominance. Those three things are all symbolic of that. And then you take the fourth thing, that the economy is going into the recession. Putin's greatest strength was always that he brought prosperity to Russians, more prosperity than they ever enjoyed in their 1,000-year history. If you take these things away, the rug comes out from under him. And this is what led me to say his luck just may be actually really finally. No, I'm not kidding. Running out this time. No. Yeah, I know I've said this before, but maybe this time it's serious. I guess if I could hedge that as much as humanly possible. What do you think? Is his luck really running out? Because it really is the economy, stupid.
Well, first of all, we were not writing him off 2 or 3 years ago or something like this. We were writing him off as a political regime, as a sort or, you know, type of political regime. And this political regime actually changed from that time.
Yeah,
and
it was almost like it was a coup inside of Putin.
Yes, yep. Yes. We were speaking about a serious leader of a quiet, rich and strong country, which is a responsible political leader who, you know, is supported by a serious part of population, not because of propaganda, but because of something.
Because he delivered credit's true, he delivered something.
And in this particular sense or meaning, of course, his regime finished, you know, something about 2 years ago.
Yep.
And now we observe absolutely different thing. We were not going and still are not going to write him off personally as a political leader, or if you want, as a dictator. No. Of course he could invent, you know, whatever trick he wants. And we are trying to speak not personally. We are not trying to imitate, you know, Gabriel Garcia Marquez or some Latin American writers who were and still are very interested in the psychology of dictatorship and dictators and so on. We are trying to analyze a real political situation. And from this point of view, of course, Putinism as a combination of economic, social, political factors, some ideological stuff and so on is old.
Well, going back to my question here, I mean, one thing Putin has been very, very, very lucky. I mean, imagine if he had to had the oil prices Yeltsin had to deal with, for example, or imagine what Yeltsin would have done with the oil prices Putin had to deal with. I mean, it's an interesting counterfactual, but he's been very, very lucky. And this is my question now. is his luck running out? Because oil prices are going down, they ain't going back up, I don't think, at any time soon. The ruble's going down, and barring some major central bank intervention that would deplete Russia's currency reserves, it ain't going back up. The economy is headed to recession. Facts are pesky things here. Is his luck finally running out? Nina, did you
yeah, just one a bit to your set of unlucky events of this week. There is also a blow up in Grozny, which
was a big deal. Yeah.
We don't know whether it was one of those blow ups that just happened because they happen all the time, or we actually really witnessing the return of the brutal Chechen insurgency, and in some ways could be in response to the Muslim population that is being now oppressed in Crimea. I mean, we don't know how these things are really related, and it could be that. So that could be another sign of something. I completely agree with Kirill that the end of that type of leadership actually ended when Putin came back as president. I wrote an article which was called Putin's Final Act, and I was not talking about Putin being done tomorrow, but I was talking about Putin who lost the legitimacy of that system. So I think that's something that we should think about. As for luck, I mean, you know, in America, you know, as you a good American, you know, people say people create their own luck. So in some ways, yes, he was lucky, but he would say, I created my own luck. I use as a judo master once again. I use those openings that I created my own advantages. But it is entirely possible that world economic or global situation, political situation is such that it would be very difficult for him to find lucky openings. And that would be where he has lost his luck.
So the window of opportunity is maybe closing for him. I mean, another thing I raised in my blog this week was that one of the other ways that Putin, and he masterfully played this, one of the other sources of his strength is he was able to integrate Russia into the global economy, make it appear to be a respectable player in the international community, joining the G8 and so on, but at the same time flouting its rules all the time and getting away with it. I mean, just getting away with it. I mean, even, you know, up to the point of behaving like a rogue state and invading Georgia back in 2008. But I mean, things like ignoring Europe's anti-monopoly laws, for example, in the way Gazprom does business in Europe. He was able to basically break all the rules and still get treated like a respectable player. And as I put in the blog, he jumped the shark with Crimea. He basically, he went too far. And now the West can no longer even pretend he's a partner anymore. I mean, you had this kind of charade of we'll pretend you're a respectable partner in the international community, and you'll pretend to sort of act like one, at least publicly. And that's the mask is off on that now. And that's a key source of Russia's strength. I mean, they're Russian state companies, Russian companies, period, can't get refinancing for the massive debt they owe right now. The chickens are coming home to roost in a lot of ways here. So this is another way that the luck is running out. I don't see how he gets out of this. I just don't see. Kirill.
Let's put the problem into a bit wider historical and political context.
I knew you were going to do that.
Yes.
if you mention Immanuel Kant, I'm going to shut your microphone off.
No. Just speaking about very pragmatic things, you know, and very realistic things and real politics, actually. Putin and his regime, in some sense, was the product or result of post 9/11 world. And that is the foundation, the very foundation of his luck. I'm speaking not just about the idea that in the fight with Muslim extremism and terrorism and so on, Russia could be a very good partner and ally and so on. Yeah. That's true. But what about oil prices and so on? The level of the oil prices in the 2000s is the result, in some sense, the result of the war against terror.
Well, but it's mainly the result of increasing demand out of China, if I understand
partly the tension in the Muslim world, which is, you know, again, partly is oil producing and so on. So I think that is a very important thing. But the situation which was, you know, which we can describe as post 9/11 is all over now. because Islamic State and the situation around Syria and in some sense Iraq and so on is absolutely different than that was around, you know, Al-Qaeda and so on. West doesn't need Putin and Russia as a partner in this situation no more, or as a 100% partner, firstly. Secondly, now they see Russia as an enemy, not as a, you know, partner or the, you know, like a sort of a distant observer of the situation in different parts of the world. Thirdly, we live in the situation after European Union crisis, which began in, started in 2008 with the economic crisis and which was, you know, quite hot even, you know, 1 year ago. And now it's, I cannot say it's all over, but the crisis inside European Union is not such harsh as it was because they, European countries, they
did what Germany told them to do.
No. Because they found out that there is something dangerous on the, you know, eastern border of European Union. It's not the time, a proper time to be in crisis, you know, from now on and so on. So I think that this luck, Putin's luck, was based on the coincidences on various, you know, international processes and so on. And now situation changed.
I would also add to your thing, and I mentioned Germany for a reason to segue into this, but I mean, it's also happened at a time where Germany is truly coming into its own as a world power. In a very big way. A lot of this emerged out of the European economic crisis, where basically Germany had to basically bail out those economies that got in trouble. But now Germany's like dominance of the EU is pretty unquestioned right now, and that's one thing. But the other thing is Russia just lost Germany. Germany was Russia's biggest advocate in Europe, and they've lost them. Yes, Nina.
That's what I was actually going to say. You said that Putin jumped the shark with Crimea. I actually think that Crimea, if he played it differently or there would be a different set of circumstances, Crimea would have been swallowed. But what I think really killed him is MH17.
Yeah.
And that's when he suddenly blamed it all on everybody else instead of just saying, people, we're so sorry, our heart goes. And then when he stood up, talking about Germany, when he stood up Angela Merkel for 4 hours in Milan, I think that's what basically, he burned those bridges.
Yeah.
I think that's when finally the West said, or Europe said, you know what, this guy that cannot be dealt with. And I actually think that this is such a brilliant idea of Kirill, that he was lucky because of 9/11, because suddenly he was able to offer something to the West as a partner that the Soviet Union almost never had a chance to offer. He was an equal partner. And remember in 2007 when it began unraveling and he started whining that the West doesn't recognize? Because by 2008, the post 9/11 environment was a different environment anymore. And that's where Russia started losing the partnership, precisely because Russia was not needed. After 2008, the problem was, what was the problem? The problem was the economic crisis. So Putin actually went to Georgia to say, no, pay attention to me. I still matter. I'm still important.
Well, yeah, and a big shift you have to say was 2004 in the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, which he was convinced was some kind of a Western plot. The Rose Revolution in Georgia. These things kind of changed the way Putin looked at the West.
But he didn't do anything at the time. By 2008, he was ready to, because the West was no longer. I think he even left presidency because he was still playing with that Western democratic formula. Otherwise, he could have stayed. There's no problem for him to stay. But he did give a respect to the Constitution. But I think when he did it and then he realized that the world changed, as Kirill very correctly pointed out, that was the beginning of the end.
Yeah, this is a big question that I guess historians are going to have to answer. After all, we're all gone. But what was that? Was that a plan by Putin to kind of use Medvedev as a kind of a chess piece, or did he change his mind during the Medvedev presidency? I still honestly don't know what the answer to that question is, but it's an interesting one to ponder. And on Germany, you're right. Standing up Merkel was a symbolic move. But I mean, it goes beyond Merkel. The stuff I've been reading now is the German elite, even the industrial lobby, is turning against Steinmeier. When some MP from the Social Democratic Party suggested that the West recognize Russia's annexation of Crimea, it was Walter Steinmeier that slapped this MP down. Steinmeier is the figure in the German government who is always considered to be the most pro-Russian. Merkel very pragmatically felt you had to deal with Putin, but she, coming from the GDR, she knew exactly what she was looking at. But now she's more confrontational than anybody right now. She's basically at her wit's end with him. Just stuff you're seeing that's coming out. The recent New Yorker profile, I don't know if either of you caught this, but Merkel's comment after Putin brought and Merkel is known to be afraid of dogs, and Putin thought it would be cute to bring his dog into the room while they were meeting. And later Merkel was interviewed about, this is the first time I saw this comment. She said, oh, he just has to do things like that to prove he's a man. This is what he's like. It was a devastating comment. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion about the problems facing Putin and take a closer look at how the Russian public may react to this. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ, and also joining us via Skype from New York City is Nina Khrushcheva, a professor at the New School and author of the recently published book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and the newly launched Power Vertical feed at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
First of all, I would like to thank all of you for your support, for the unity and solidarity in the fateful moments when a lot is at stake in the future of our country. Together this year, we have gone through trials that only a mature and consolidated nation, a really sovereign and powerful state, can stand up to. Russia has proven by its deeds that it can defend its compatriots, that it can stand up for the truth and justice with honor. Our country has done it thanks to you, citizens of Russia.
Well, that, of course, is Putin praising the strength and perseverance of the Russian people. Another strength of the Russian people, and Nina, you alluded to this a bit in the first half, it could be argued, is their ability to laugh in the face of looming disaster. A joke you mentioned that making the rounds in Moscow says, what do oil, the ruble, and Putin have in common? Well, they'll all turn 63 this year. Putin, of course, will turn 63 in October. I suspect the ruble and oil might get to 63 a little bit before that, but we'll see. For Putin, a lot is riding on the patience and perseverance of the Russian people. When hard times hit, as economists are predicting they will they stick with him? Will they trade prosperity for patriotism? Because that seems to be what Putin's betting on right now, that they'll trade prosperity for patriotism. Now, before that, they traded freedom for prosperity. And on that score, there seems to be two opinions. One rests on the stereotype that Russians have an enormous capacity for suffering and will endure any hardship the state throws at them. They will eat grass for the sake of the motherland, as one of my colleagues put it. Another says that these Russians, this generation of Russians, these post-Soviet Russians are different. They've tasted prosperity and they won't want to give it up. This is an argument I often make, and I'm still wondering if I'm going to be right or not. I want to quote the economist Vyacheslav Inozemtsev on this. Russians are no fanatics, and they value that it took them a lot of work to achieve what they've achieved in recent years. If they are already used to trading freedom for well-being, few will be prepared to trade well-being for demagoguery. Nino, which one's right? Because you and Kirill have the virtue of being Russian. I am only an observer of Russian affairs. Which one of these is right?
Well, I agree with Inozemtsev. Something that I was saying, that Putin is in a disadvantage now because he's using empty Soviet words and empty Soviet slogans and sort of calls for unity and control of government, control of food and whatnot. And I do think that there is a new, I mean, we are all, I mean, my whole book, as you know, all about the Russians say we're killed and imprisoned, but our parades were great. So the state carries an incredible, deal of importance for the Russians. But at the same time, we've never seen free Russia before. We don't know how people who got used to cashmere sweaters would fare without those cashmere sweaters. You know, are they ready to use galoshes again? And, you know, that's what they see on the store shelves. So I really don't know, but I'm, you know,
what's your instinct though? Because I mean, between that, they will eat grass for the motherland versus they're not going to give up their cashmere sweaters. There's a lot of space in between there. But
that was my whole point, is that Putin is doing Stalin 1946. We are going to tighten our belts and you know, go against all these Western enemies, and we are going to be a great country. But the reality of the ground is very, very different. And for example, I'm sure you followed the latest polls. He has gone down to 72%.
72? I saw 82.
Well, I saw 72.
You saw 72. Interesting. Right.
So he has gone to 72%. And okay, fine. He's gone to 78. But he's gone down because all these empty slogans really do not. I just was in Moscow for 2 days ago. I came back. I went into the store and it was pitiful. It was absolutely pitiful. And all these older ladies and even younger ladies were grumbling because there was no milk or there's no kefir or there's no something. So all these things, I think, really suggest that Inozemtsev is correct. Fine, let's not go cashmere sweaters, but we do want colors. We don't want just one galoshes for everybody. And I think this is something that Russia has not experienced before. We said it before, the people will go to the street. But my feeling that it is much likelier that his own elites are going to take him out rather than the people who would go to the streets, because that he has taken care of, because all these laws that are being put forward really prevent people from demonstrating. Although I was in Moscow for the doctors.
Yeah, no, that was an interesting.
It was quite an important and quite large demonstration. So I wouldn't dismiss that, but I think in combination of the elites and the people, that's where Putin's end may come. Putin's end may come. Although, of course, we shouldn't discard the Siloviki, because these are the people now he's betting on, and whether they're ready to give him up for something else, like say Sergei Ivanov, is still not clear.
Kirill, what's your instinct? Will they eat grass or will they not want to give up their cashmere sweaters or something in between?
First of all, there is no such whole thing as Russians. There are several social stratas and
of
so
course.
On. We can speak about, you know, the whole nation as a, you know, one.
This is true, but we're talking
yes.
about it as a critical mass here.
First of all, I think those who are, you know, fervent supporters of Putin's politics, they never changed their freedom for prosperity, because they never had prosperity at all.
Well, that's what I mean. They yes. gave up their freedom in order yes. to attain prosperity.
Yes. This is the lower classes of Russian society, first of all. And Putin, 2 or maybe 2.5 years ago, decided to change his electorate base, to change his support from those who are, you know, sort of middle class to those who are, you know, much lower in the society, first of all. Secondly, those who changed their freedom for prosperity, I'm speaking about middle class, of course, they're relatively supportive for Putin now. But this is the particular group which could change their attitude to the regime. And I think this must be, from now on, must be the main focus group from, you know, future Russian opposition, because this is the most important part of Russian society. But at the same time, we must understand.
And this is no longer confined to Moscow and Petersburg. This is all over Russia. It's in every major city in Russia. You have this.
But on the other hand, don't forget that the biggest, the largest part of so-called South Russian middle class and so on, they're bureaucrats. Mm-hmm. It's not real, you know, middle class in Western terms and so on. There are governmental bureaucrats, people from, you know, police, from local administrations.
Budgetniki.
And they are quite disappointed. Don't forget about them, because even 1 year ago, they were traveling all around the world freely. They had a lot of money. They had, you know, some perspectives. Their children, you know, studied at the, you know, schools and the universities in Great Britain and wherever. And all this, you know, is over.
Do you think, and this again is another key question for me on this, and I think it's another one of the keys to where this might be going. I mentioned earlier how Putin managed to navigate Russia into the into being a respectable member of the international community and an integrated player in the world economy, and while at the same time flaunting its rules. Well, the benefits of that were achieved not just by the elite, but by this middle class that did get to travel and basically live like Europeans. Now, if as the ruble goes down, their ability to travel, regardless of whether they're allowed to or not, is going to be diminished, because the ruble doesn't buy you as many euros anymore. It doesn't buy you as many dollars anymore. Will they make the connection that they are losing this because of their government's behavior? Will they make that connection? Or will they blame it on external factors? And again, let me continue with my logic here, because in the speech, Putin, that we all joked about the speculators, and we know who you are. He had this bit, and he says that I'm asking the government to take measures against the speculators that are causing the ruble to go down, and we know who you are. Is this an attempt to deflect blame so people won't make that connection? Nina, go ahead.
Just actually going back to your point that Putin's luck is running out, and something we've discussed over this podcast is exactly that. We're talking about bored audience. That's that bored audience, because all these middle class people who were those who worked for the government and they were paid well. It does seem that Putin are losing them, because when the words, I mean, I teach propaganda, so we always know that when the words are not supported, at least by semblance of reality, then it becomes an issue and a problem. Of course, they make a connection. I think they've already made a connection.
And they won't be fooled by the claim that this is all speculators' fault?
I think that's what he's relying on. And that's why I think his speech is so weak, because it's so Soviet. Look, Stalin could get away at that time with the speculators. I mean, Russians are, maybe they are a little gulaggy, but they're quite, I mean, we are quite sophisticated. Of course they make this connection. And he can scream about the West all he wants, but the reality is people do want to travel and do want their cashmere sweaters and their greeny leaves that you cannot get in Moscow stores anymore. No, seriously, you go back to potatoes, and that's really not what Russians have settled for. So his more bellicose rhetoric really doesn't meet reality anymore, and that's what those bored looks at the elites, on the elite or whatever middle class faces, or some of the middle class faces, were. And I think that's where, you know, that whole, I keep talking about Stalin of 1946, really is just not working out for Putin. I think that as heard. You know, Russians are heard of slaves or serfs or whatever they could be. But at the same time, once they start losing enthusiasm and faith, then the story, they can suffer more. But I don't think that in this case, that suffering will really take a long, long time, because there's really no benefit to it.
Right.
This just, unlike in the Soviet Union before Brezhnev on 1975, really there's no benefit to it. Remember, to confront that, Brezhnev did go into Afghanistan in 79, and the system unraveled very quickly after. I would say Crimea was that kind of Afghanistan.
Kirill, what do you think? Will they be able to deflect blame for the inevitable recession that's coming? I mean, again, the speculators is the kind of caricature of it, but that to me was just a caricature that we're blaming the economic problems we're about to face on some undefined other. Whether it's speculators or the West that was planning on doing sanctions anyway, regardless, this is another interesting line from yesterday's speech. Will he be able to deflect blame when that recession comes next year?
Well, actually, I don't know, because here, being no more responsible politician, can invent everything, you know, and even, you know, very dangerous tricks. So to predict something, you know, if you want to predict something, you must live inside some, you know, rational limitations. And from now on, we cannot, you know, discuss future in this sense, because from Crimean occupation, we are not inside these rational limitations of borders no more.
To paraphrase Angela Merkel, we're in another reality. We're dealing with somebody who's in another reality.
Yes, in the high spiritual reality of Chersonese centuries and so on. So I cannot predict, but we must, I think, we must, it's more interesting and more important for the future of this country and so on to try to analyze and to understand what's going on inside this middle class, which is, you know, which is not united, because it consists of at least two parts, which is the larger part is, you know, this budgetniki, bureaucrats.
The other part is the creative class.
Not creative, but entrepreneurial, you know, class, in the wider sense. You know, it could be whatever. And they have different political interests, by the way.
Yeah.
Those who depend on budget, who depend on, you know, state salaries and so on, and at the same time, don't forget about, they were not just well paid. They were well bribed.
Right.
And now the situation is also, you know, not almost over, but, you know, the stream of the bribes is weakening from day to day. And, of course, their real political interest is to keep the situation of, say, you know, 2009, 2010.
That's gone.
Yeah, it's gone. It's not, they are not Democrats. They are not, they don't believe in, you know, democracy, human rights, and so on. They want to be prosperous and so on. And another part of middle class is different than their political interests. It's different because, of course, they could be, you know, social democrats or, you know, neoliberals, whatever. But they, you know, in some sense, they believe in some, not Western values, but, you know, pragmatic or common sense.
We're talking about the entrepreneurial class now.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, that could be, you know, a temporary coalition between two parts of middle class in some future. But in the end, they will fight with each other because they are, you know, political enemies. And all of us who are trying to predict some, you know, future political development in Russia must understand this, you know, very clearly.
Looking through all the platitudes in this speech, because one thing a lot of people were expecting or hoping for, you noted at the outset of the podcast, the disappointment, Kirill, is some way, some plan to get Russia, some blueprint to get through this coming recession. Now, I didn't see much, but maybe some of you did. I mean, I saw the, you know, beyond the promise to punish speculators and the platitude that the sanctions are going to make us stronger because we have to rely on ourselves and we have to wean ourselves off of Western technology. We never heard how. The only thing I heard that was in any way concrete was this amnesty for offshore capital that comes back. Did you hear anything else other than that? What message was he trying to send economically here? Because I'm not quite sure I saw the economic message other than it's all somebody else's fault. Did either of you see anything?
Well, there was a bit of an economic message. I mean, he was talking about diversifying the economy and how small businesses need to be.
He's been talking about that since 2000.
Well, yes, he did. But and you, as you remember, when Dmitry Medvedev came in 2008, it was supposedly Medvedev's agenda to fix that they created.
I think it was, and he just wasn't allowed to do it.
Well, no. He created Skolkova and all these other things. I don't know if he wasn't allowed to do it. I think it's just because they started Skolkova in a very wrong Russian way. That is, they started with a golf course and a club versus actually the scientists who would come, and then there would be a golf course and the club. So, but that's, you know, basically what he was talking about, the innovations and technological developments. that seemed like a plan, but the plan, once again, I think those bored looks on people's faces, that's exactly that, because we all remember that Medvedev was doing that and went into nowhere. Remember Chubais, Anatoly Chubais was doing the nanotechnology, was going to catapult Russia into this remarkable future. Where is the nanotechnology and Anatoly Chubais? So all these things seemed like a plan, but actually they were those platitudes that Putin would say, well, and I'm going to instruct, because that's what I also thought was very interesting about the speech. He talks about that I'm going to charge so-and-so with doing so-and-so. And that was very that was very planned economy. I mean, he was basically doing the planned economy speech, something that Kirill was saying that before that, there was a combination between the sort of imperial Russian great ideology and neoliberal formulas, and that's what we did not hear. The state is going to be in control.
Did either of you find it interesting, though, that the only concrete thing that wasn't a platitude, it was an actually concrete policy that was announced, was the amnesty for capital that has left the country coming back? Basically, you're not going to be prosecuted for anything you may have done illegally to get this capital or get it out of the country. If you bring it back, we'll all is forgiven. What is there any significance of that? That I think was the only real, truly concrete economic policy that was announced at this speech.
I actually felt it was a moment of desperation, because even if you're going to do this, you really don't announce it at the State of the Nation address, because that then being interpreted, misinterpreted, and whatnot. It seemed like it was a moment of desperation. Is that, you know, I'm going to speak so loudly about it. Please do that, because with all the things that are going on in the country, who would be the idiot to bring money back into it? Who would be the idiot? So I think he was screaming loudly about it, so he himself or those board audiences would believe that that's a viable possibility.
And they've been pushing this de-offshoreization for a while now. And it's, Kirill, what did you make of that? Did you have any thoughts on that?
I think the only you know, real economic message in his speech was let's wait another 1 year. Let's wait, maybe our luck will will be back. And something good will happen. So let's wait. So I can speak, I can say, name a lot of good things which we were doing, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. Just, just wait. Just wait, and something will happen. Something good will happen. I think that's the only economic message which we can read in this speech, and that's all. Of course, the speech, as we were saying, was very awaited. So a lot of people, speculating that he will start a new economic policy.
That he was distancing himself from the Siloviki. There was a lot of stuff in the media about this.
Yeah, and as usual, by the way, as usual, nothing as a result. Nothing as a result. But when such things happened, say, in 2007, that was not of such importance, because the situation in the economy was quite good. Oil prices were quite high and so on. So everything was perfect. And there were no any need from this point of view, particular point of view, to change something. Of course, really, the country needed to change not something, but almost everything. But from the point of view of of the elite of say 2007, then nothing must be changed. Nothing, everything is perfect, But now in 2014, during the last the events in economy, in politics, in in Ukraine and so on, of course everyone. Not everyone, of course, but some people, especially from the elite and business circles and so on, they were waiting for something, for some, not message, but maybe for some signal that something will change. No. And I think that is a very important statement in some sense, this emptiness, this foggish emptiness.
Stay the course.
Yes. It's just, we'll go on, and that's all.
Nina, any last thoughts before we wrap it up?
I think it's a great conclusion. It's a perfect conclusion for your podcast, because we were talking about the luck running out and whether he would be able to turn around. And I think with what Kirill said, the message was well, I'm giving you that Soviet speech and it's a status quo and let's give me more time, I'll figure it out. And that is basically where we should leave it, because we have to see whether you know, gods will give him more time and his luck will return, or the global environment has changed so much that unfortunately the Putin Russia is no longer something that is a viable alternative to anything else.
All right, so we're back to defiance, denial, delusion, and perhaps Kirill will be right. It'll turn into disappointment. We've come full circle.
It's already, remember, we were talking, I think in this program, we were talking about various forms of immigration, you know, how Russians emigrate. So the last set of immigrants is that immigration of disappointment, is that all the things that people came back to Russia after 91 and then after 2000, they're going away again, precisely because that system cannot offer them anything anymore.
All right. Well, on that note, we will wrap it up for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from London has been Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine, NZ. Also joining us via Skype from New York City has been Nina Khrushcheva, a professor at the New School and author of the recently published book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. Thank you both for an enlightening discussion.
Thank you, my pleasure.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome and indispensable colleague, Pavel Buturin, proprietor of the equally indispensable and totally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, as well as the newly launched Power Vertical feed. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.